We will begin today with a possible reconsideration and work session on House Bill 3044. House Bill 3044 was inappropriately stated as passed by the committee. Chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended and reconsideration of House Bill 3044 be taken up and being taken up immediately. Is there objection?
Yes.
So noted. Hearing one objection, consideration passes. Chair requests unanimous consent that the motion on House Bill 3044 to do pass as amended be printed, engrossed, and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference be reconsidered. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. We need a representative. Perhaps you could provide us a Dash 6 amendment, a motion to adopt the Dash 6 amendment. Representative Dalton?
Mr. Chair, yeah. I move the Dash 6 amendment
to
House Bill 3044.
Thank you very much, Representative. Representative Dalton moves the Dash 6 amendment to House Bill 3044. Discussion? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I won't go through my whole litany of objections to this bill, but for the record, I'm against it because I think it's unnecessary and I think it's an unfunded mandate on the school districts.
Okay, thank you. We don't need a formal vote on this, do we? Dana, call roll.
Aye.
Excused.
No.
This is on the amendment. Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. The amendment passes to House Bill 3044. Okay. Representative Dalton, do you have a motion for us?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3044 as amended to the floor. To the floor with a due pass recommendation and be referred by prior reference to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is that the right motion?
Thank you, Representative. That is correct, is it not?
Just read it.
Yeah. Representative Dalto moves House Bill 3040 to do pass as amended, be printed, engrossed, and then to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Discussion? Okay. Hearing none, Gina, would you call the roll, please? Excused.
No.
Representative
Nolan? Aye.
Representative
Scott? Aye. Representative Dalton? No. Aye. Aye. House Bill 3044, as amended, is declared passed.
And so it's Ways and Means.
Excuse me. Very good. Move to Ways and Means. Excellent point, Representative. Okay, very good. That's what happens sometimes if you don't do it right the first time. So we apologize for that. Well, we will close the possible reconsideration work session on House Bill 3044, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 11A. Jim, you have a summary for us.
Yes, sir. Senate Bill 11A. Repeals laws pertaining to county school districts, directs county school districts to become common school district, declares an emergency effective July 1, 2003.
Okay.
I believe we have a sign-up sheet.
Yes, we do. Okay, we have a number of people signed up to testify. Ernie Blass could come up, please. Amy Sugg. Good afternoon. Either of you may start whenever you are ready.
Well, Ernie's the expert on this, so maybe I'll just give a brief explanation of why I'm here, and then he can follow me up. I'm here today as a parent of three children in a very rural community of Oregon, Wasco County. And we are asking you to consider the impact of passing Senate Bill 11 and the repercussions of eliminating all the language that exists currently in the county unit statute. We think there are some really great things about that county unit statute that need to be considered more thoroughly before just throwing them out altogether. Last year, in an effort to reduce the overhead of operating four school districts in a very sparsely populated county in Oregon, petitioners under the county unit statute asked voters to approve a single county unit school district in Wasco County. We didn't have Senate Bill 519 at the time, which I think was a pretty good explanation of school funding and how much it costs to run small schools, and that would, you know, may have had an impact on how we would have been able to present our case about basically reducing costs and reducing overhead. The county unit statute did not pass at that time because it included some smaller school districts in South County that were totally opposed to joining the unit. But later was reintroduced in November and passed, taking in the two large school districts in the Dalles, Oregon. And so now if you had a chance to, I'm sure none of you did, but at the Cherry Festival Parade we recently had, our two high school bands were marching together. I mean, we're starting to make strides towards working together and eliminating those boundaries that divided a very small town. The point is that people are finding that the two school districts have more in common than they thought. The idea that working together, we may be able to provide more opportunities and fewer cuts that directly affect kids is really working. The county unit statute made all this possible because it's the only way that people can take this issue to a vote, with, you know, circumventing the school districts. The school district's boards, and in this case, even after it passed with a 51% majority in both districts, neither board supported it at any time. So we think that speaks to the fact of how difficult it is for two school districts to come down and decide exactly how they're going to merge and consolidate, and this allows for some more flexibility that way. I believe that the Oregon State Legislature should be building up local control and local ability to influence schools and not further restricting it. There are several House bills presented this session that deal with forming a task force to look at the consolidation and merger issue. We would like the legislature to carefully consider further limiting the public's ability to have a voice in their own local schools and how they're run. Accountability is an essential component of any successful business or public entity. The county unit statute provides that to the people of Oregon. Parents and patrons of Oregon should have this option available to them as a cost-saving measure, particularly in these difficult economic times. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, Representative Farr.
Ms. Sugg, I just wanted to thank you. Back last month, you called my office and kind of gave me a heads up to start looking at this bill. And that's what it takes sometimes because there's so many bills hanging out there.
I learned the hard way last session. Our school bill didn't pass, and so our school was closed, our small school. Mm-hmm. And so we've learned a lot about how this whole process works. So it's been one good thing.
You did the right thing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. My name is Ernie Blatz. I'm from the Dalles, Oregon also. I'm against Senate Bill 11 for repealing the county unit. That would only leave you with the merger statute. That if you read the merger statute, it says that the largest district takes over unless both boards are agreeing on positions. In the Dalles, over 40 years of history, people tried to bring the two school districts together under the merger statute. But the boards wouldn't agree. The largest district having the power would say they were going to do whatever they wanted to do, pretty much, which kept both school districts apart. What had happened over the last few years was that funding decreasing. One school was losing programs and students weren't getting the education that they needed. And so it wasn't about the students anymore. It was about the power that the boards held that they were trying to keep control over. And that power was lost. You couldn't work through the boards to bring this together with the two school districts to help save the administration costs and better education for the children. Through the county unit, we were able to bring the community together as one school district without anybody taking over. And that's a big thing in the county unit that you can't do in the merger statute. In the merger statute, you can rename the district, but it's still the largest one takes over. In the county unit, we have a lot of, we have options there that that we need to keep, especially with there's another bill with the committee being put together to look on the consolidations of schools. We don't want to throw this one out yet because we have a committee that's trying to get formed and they can use some of the information off this unit. I disagree with the unit as far as the largest simple majority vote will win this. And I've faxed information on amendments to all of you on the two amendments that we would need that would take care of this, and then we wouldn't have any complaints because the largest one wouldn't take over. The first amendment would be to section 333060 to read, election to adopt county unit system. This chapter shall not become effective in any county unit until the same has been regularly submitted to the electors of the proposed county school district at a general special election, and 51% of the votes cast from each district are in favor of making this chapter effective. Okay. The second amendment would be to section 333126, subsection 2B, to read as follows, immediately after the election pursuant to paragraph A of this subsection, the county court having jurisdiction of the petition shall canvass the vote upon the question of forming a county school district. If 51% of the votes cast from each district or area named in the petition is in favor of forming the county school district, the county court shall declare that formation of the county school district has been approved. If formation of this district has been approved, then the county school district shall go into effect 30 days after the election, except that when the election is held in June, the district shall go into effect July 1st of calling the election. These simple amendments, two simple amendments, will take care of the complaint that the largest district can take over by a simple majority vote. We can't really throw out a whole unit if we can amend it. Plus, the cost of going back and deleting any reference to the county unit has to be a lot more expensive than if we just put two amendments in it. The community in the Dalles is really coming together as one community. We were able to use this unit to bring two school districts together, and now we have a lot of building to do, but it's a very positive thing going on in the community that we couldn't have done without the county unit. And I don't know if there's other districts or other, you know, communities out there that might be in the same boat where the boards aren't working together, where the people would like an option other than the option they have. One of the other options that you have is to take the board members and recall the board members, and if they can recall the superintendent or they can fire the superintendent. The other options to trying to get a new administration or bringing two school districts together just get real ugly. You have to point a finger at somebody and blame somebody. The county unit doesn't, you don't have to do that. It's more of a positive thing. You can say, we're trying to bring two districts together. We don't want anybody to take over. So this is how we do it. It's not saying that one was bad and one was good, or they're both bad. It's just we need to bring them together and start new, and so everybody can feel like they're working on one and nobody's taking over. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Any questions?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you
very much. Yeah. Do I see Senator Farioli here? I do indeed. Come up, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ted Farioli, Senate District 30. Mr. Chairman, the Senate Bill 11, if I could give you just a little bit of background. There are a couple of mechanisms in state statute for requiring the, or allowing, the consolidation of school districts. One of them was passed in the 50s, and it would essentially allow a larger district to take over a smaller district without an affirmative vote of the smaller district. And I guess I could characterize that almost as a hostile takeover mechanism. It's a simple situation where might could, in fact, make right, simply because of the weight, the preponderance of the vote in the larger district. The smaller district would have virtually nothing to say about that. There is another statute, a much more recent statute, that simply requires an affirmative vote of both districts in order to make a merge. And that actually is far less a hostile takeover issue than it is a negotiated merger. And what this bill before you does is simply puts to rest the antique statute, the older 1950s version, which could allow a district simply to work its will on a smaller, weaker district. It simply just pulls all of that out of state statute. And we think that this bill is very valuable because, in fact, we're encouraging people to try to do things more efficiently. We're encouraging people in these days of very difficult financial situations to do everything they can to cut costs and everything they can to be cooperative. And we think that very central to that issue is to remove the threat that a larger district could simply subsume the territory of a smaller district with a vote of a large district. So I guess what this does, it's one of those equalization things. They say that the Lord made big men and small men, and Colonel Colt made everybody equal. Well, this, in fact, is one of those situations that if we take this out of the statutes, it simply removes the potential threat of a larger district taking a hostile position and doing a forced merger with a smaller district. It seems to be a very simple, straightforward resolution of that kind of a threat issue. It did come out of a situation in Wasco County where this statute had not been used for decades, and all of a sudden it was used to try to do a forced merger. And that issue is resolved. It's a moot point in Wasco County now. The parties got together and figured out how to coexist. But what it illustrated is that we still have that statute on the books. And it was my opinion that we ought to remove that potential threat simply to make boundary adjustments a matter of collaboration and give all people the franchise to vote whether they wanted to do it or not. The statute that we have on the books, the newer statute, requires an affirmative vote of both districts to make the boundary adjustment. The antique statute does not. So it's my opinion, and I hope you'll concur, that that we consolidate our approach and make simple the issue by allowing one mechanism for consolidation of school district boundaries and make that by an affirmative vote of both the target districts. So I'll try to answer any questions if I can. If not, I'll defer them to
other. Representative Galto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question for the good senator. I have a couple of just email messages from the Dalles, two or three, and just kind of wanted to get an indication of why folks out there aren't happy.
Well, I could send you some emails on navigability or some emails on some other issues that I'm struggling with. I believe some folks view this as a populist issue where a dedicated group of people can, in fact, make major social change or compel people under threat to negotiate. And believe me, sometimes, even in this building, believe it or not, that's a tactic that's used. But when you're talking about something as serious as the potential merger of two school districts, it really needs to be more than a situation of might makes right. It really needs to be a situation where people collaborate, come to the table, go to their own voters, go to their own patrons and parents, and convince them that it's a good idea rather than force them. Some people don't like to put down the hammer. And I would suggest to you that putting down the hammer in the issue of school mergers, boundary mergers, is a very important principle.
Thank you, Senator. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, I suppose I should know this question. If there were three districts or four districts that were proposing a merger, would all four have to concur, or would they do it two by two, or how would that work?
I'm not sure, Mr. Chairman, to Senator Hobson about the sequencing, but it would require an affirmative vote of virtually every district in order to create the merger. And that really does speak to the issue of collaboration and moving toward a solution rather than being driven off the cliff to a solution.
Follow-up?
Also, during these tough times and in line with some legislation working its way, I hope, through, I'm looking at consolidations. Is it the intent of this to make it so if a district really doesn't want to consolidate, but the fiscal concerns make it necessary, that this will again encourage them to vote for the merger, even though they don't really want it in their heart?
Mr. Chairman, to Representative Hobson, I think this bill, if passed, leaves the issue more to a natural evolution of consequences. If two districts are thinking about a merger and discussing a merger, and the smaller of the two districts is adamantly opposed to a merger, they're going to go their financial road alone, and sooner or later they're going to figure out that there's efficiencies of scale and economies of scale that would benefit their students. And I think that natural consequence brings people to the table.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Senator.
Appreciate you coming in. Appreciate the effort to come before the committee, and thanks for considering the bill. And, Mr. Chairman, just last word. The committee may have received amendments. We're not aware of any amendments and don't support any amendments. We think the bill is a very clean solution to removing an antique piece of legislation that has caused a lot of angst among smaller school districts in Oregon.
Thank you. Okay. We'll call up John Marshall and Jack Henderson, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. John Marshall, representing the Oregon School Boards Association, appearing in front of you today in support of Senate Bill 11 as it came to you from the Senate. As Senator Farioli suggested, this is, we believe, an archaic statute. There are four school districts in Oregon that were organized under these county unit statutes: the Klamath County Unit, the Josephine County Unit, Crook County Unit, and Lincoln County Unit. They were organized probably 25 or 30 years ago. The issue, I think, in this bill is fundamental. And the question is, should citizens in their communities have a say on how their school districts are organized? This bill comes before you because of a circumstance in the Dalles. Some citizens in the Wasco County, for whatever reasons, and I won't try to second-guess their motives, but wanted to create a county unit out of the four school districts in Wasco County. I think the real issue was the merger of two school districts very close together, the Dalles and Chenoweth. And if you drive up I-84, once you come into the Dalles, you drive into Chenoweth, and before you know it, you're in the Dalles school district. The vote, the citizens used this statute through a petition process, got the issue before the voters in March of last year. Because of a variety of reasons, not the least of which were the citizens in the more rural southern part of the county, particularly the Duffer and Wasco school districts, didn't want to join the Dalles and Chenoweth. They didn't want to join either, let alone be a part of a larger school district up on the river. The measure failed. The citizens brought a measure back which used these statutes to combine just the Dalles and Chenoweth. And last November, that measure passed. And so process is in place to work out the details so the new Dalles/Chenoweth school district will come into effect on July 1, 2004. An assertion has been made that there are not opportunities for citizen involvement in school district mergers, and that is not true. Chapter 330, the more recent of the organization statutes to which Senator Farioli alluded, allows for citizen involvement. And I don't want to get into a great deal of detail about how that works unless you want me to. But essentially, if two boards agree that their school districts ought to be merged, two or more school districts, if all those boards agree, they take that merger request to the ESD board, who sits in this case as a boundary board, and it's a done deal unless citizens in one of those affected school districts decide they don't want that to happen. Then they file what's called a remonstrance, which is an effective petition, to send the issue to an election. The election is held in any area from which the petition comes. So, for example, Beaverton and Hillsboro. The board decides we want to merge those two school districts, and citizens say, no, we don't. They get a petition. If the folks in Beaverton get a petition, or the folks in Hillsboro, or both, then it goes to an election in those districts where the petition was filed. And if it's a vote in both of those school districts, it has to pass in both of those school districts before the merger occurs. There are some discussions down in North Douglas County between Yonkala and North Douglas. They're interested in merging. Both boards have agreed to proceed with that merger. It sounds like there's broad community support by citizens. In that case, those two school boards take their petition to the ESD board, sitting as the boundary board, and it's a done deal. And chances are there won't be a remonstrance filed. The point is that we have in ORS Chapter 330 ample opportunities for citizens to decide whether or not they want to merge their school district. A bill that you have approved suggests that we ought to do a study over the next 2 years to determine whether there ought to be further school district consolidations. 11 years ago, or 12 years ago, I guess it was, the 1991 legislature decided that school districts ought to be merged and passed a bill ordering those mergers to occur. You could order those mergers to occur by legislative fiat, like you did in 1991, or you could suggest in certain communities or all communities that there be a vote. School districts are creatures of the state, creatures of the legislature, and you can organize them in any way you so choose. The point is, and the bottom line, I think, is that, one, there are ample opportunities for citizens to be involved in how their schools are organized, which create opportunities for locally elected boards to make that decision. And if citizens disagree with that decision, they can engage in the discussion through the petition process. The larger fundamental question, I think, is should citizens in each individual school district have a say in how their school districts are organized? And until this body decides whether or not they want to create some kind of a mandate on school district organization, we believe that the answer to that question is absolutely and certainly yes. And so, again, there are ample opportunities for school districts to reorganize on their own motion, and we believe, we agree with Senator Farioli that Chapter 333 is an archaic statute and are supporting its repeal. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to respond to any questions.
Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know, Mr. Marshall, how many of those kinds of mergers or consolidations you've had where both boards did, in fact, agree to merge in the land, well, since 1991 when the big mess was?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson, since 1991, school districts have merged because of the legislative mandate. I'm not aware of any school district mergers that have occurred on school districts' own motion other than the activity that's going on down in North Douglas County.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, John. Please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the House Education Committee, it's a pleasure to be here this afternoon. For the record, my name is Jack Henderson. I'm the superintendent of the Duper School District. Duper is a small school district located 13 miles south of the Dalles, spanning north of the Columbia River. Duper School District currently has 270 students in it. I am here today to lobby for passage of Senate Bill 11 for many of the same reasons, for all the same reasons that Mr. Marshall and Senator Farioli spoke to. 2 years ago, a group of people in Wasco County determined that it would be best, in their opinion, to form a countywide school district in Wasco County to, as was spoken to earlier, to save money, size of scale, efficiencies, and things like that. The Duper School District, as well as the South Wasco County School District, was adamantly opposed to that process. They went through a process, and a great statement about the voters in Wasco County is, as a result of the hard work that was done by the Duper residents as well as the Maupin residents, which is the South Wasco County School District, the measure was defeated, but narrowly defeated in Wasco County. Our concern is with ORS 333 on the books is that it gives a mechanism where small school districts could be taken and controlled by someone else, losing local control over their school districts simply because they do not have the voter population, the registered voter population, than the other school districts would have. Dewford, we have approximately 700 registered voters. In the Dallas, there's four to 5,000 registered voters. Obviously not a very good matchup. We're very proud of the Dewford School District, where we have been and where we are going in the future. I think that it's a mistake to talk about bigger is better. That's what comes up all the time. We'll have efficiencies. We'll do this. We'll do that. We'll do the other thing. We will save the state taxpayers money. I'd like for you to consider this. One of the platforms that the group advertised for the Pasco Countywide School District, including the entire Wausau County, was that they would be able to get programs back to students. Well, I'm very pleased to report to you today that the Dewford School District and other small school districts its size are the remaining school districts in the state of Oregon that have the programs that most Oregon students enjoyed pre-Measure 5. In the Dewford School District, our students currently have kindergarten through 12th grade Spanish. They have kindergarten through 12th grade physical education. They have kindergarten through 12th grade music classes. We maintain a rigorous curriculum at the high school level. Our graduates do well post-high school in their post-secondary education. That is an extremely important consideration. Small school districts typically are cheaper to run than larger school districts, which I know that statement is in direct conflict to things that others say. So typically, because the average teacher in Dewford makes approximately $5,000 or $6,000 less than the average teacher in the Dalles. Administrators in the Dewford School District make significantly less than the administrators in the Dalles, and that's again an important consideration. The situation that we're in our state, obviously, you guys deal with it every day. The uncertainty, you know, the falling revenue, inability to get agreements on what is the best course of action to provide funding for schools, bring up all these questions. And people tend to grasp for simple answers for complex situations. You guys wrestle with that every day of the legislative session and in the interim. And that's a very, very important thing. My fear is that people will grasp and say, this is the best way to go. Small school districts would be without a voice, essentially without a voice in the process, causing problems for that school district with the potential to lose their school district or the say in the running of their school district. An interesting thing, you know, Dewford High School, as I said, is 13 miles south of the Dalles, very close to the Dalles. What do school districts do when they have to save money? You know, they close schools. And Dewford High School, the community of Dewford is very proud of Dewford High School, the graduates, the programs that they have had in the past and look forward to the future. And it is certainly something that would be takeable, if you will, by countywide school district formation. And that is why I ask you to pass through the Senate bill level. I would entertain any questions that you may have.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Nolan.
Thank you. Mr. Superintendent, did I hear you say you've got 270 students in the district?
Kindergarten through 12th grade, yes.
And how many in high school?
We currently have 93 students in our high school.
I might follow up.
Follow up.
So help me understand how it is that you managed to evade consolidation earlier on with that size of a school district. Wouldn't that school district normally have been subject to statewide requirement for consolidation?
No, because the requirement that was passed in the mid-90s for required consolidation simply spanned the K-8 level. That was the requirement. And I think another answer to your question is that the Dewford School District's always been, the Dewford School Board has always managed things in an extremely conservative way. And they've scrimped and saved and taken care of their district in that manner. Recently, in the late 90s, there was a merger with the Petersburg School District, which the Petersburg School District had approximately 50 to 60 in-district students, and then it had some other students from the Dalles that was attending the Petersburg School. Pre-merger with the Petersburg School District, the Dewford School District, if you look back, typically had between 225 and 235 students. And as I've stated a couple times today, currently we have 270 students. We are growing. A year ago, the Dewford School District had 251 students, and as I stated, we have 270 today. people are moving into the Dufresne School District to attend school there because of the programs that we currently offer. And
another follow-up.
Follow-up.
Do you know approximately what your school budget per student is?
We have 270 students in the Dufresne School District, and the school budget is looking about $2.2 million.
And my brain doesn't do that quickly. $2.2 million a year? That's a little less than $10,000 a year, maybe $8,000, $9,000 a year. So if I might follow up.
Follow up.
Is it fair for me to assume that part of that $2.2 million is the small school subsidy that you get?
That's correct.
So can you reconcile your statement that small schools are cheaper to run than large schools with your $9,000 per student budget?
I can reconcile that because the programs that we're running in our school district offer more of an education than the programs in the other school districts. For instance, District 12 in the Dalles, the larger of the two school districts in the Dalles, and the Chenoweth School District don't have all of the programs that I mentioned. The Chenoweth School District has virtually none of the specialty programs. 80 or 85% of a school's budget goes to the salaries for employees. And in my mind, it is, you can say that it's more expensive to run a small school simply because there's fewer kids there, but I would also say that what are the schools in Eastern Oregon going to do? If the idea behind school funding is that we're going to merge school districts together, well, what are we going to do with all those school districts in Eastern Oregon? Now, it creates a real dilemma. You know, there are school districts in the state of Oregon that don't have districts to merge with.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, but the premise for the small school subsidy is that it is more expensive to run small schools and it is not
right.
supposed
and,
to
and
be
I don't,
too.
And my, I guess my point was, mm-hmm. oh, I'm sorry.
My understanding is that those funds are not to augment academic programs, but to allow small schools to be able to meet the basics. And you've provided some useful information.
Mr. Chair, if I might, Representative Nolan, with all due respect, the issue before you is not whether or not 198 is too many school districts in Oregon, and whether or not some smaller school districts ought to be merged with their neighboring larger school districts. The issue is, until the legislature makes that determination, the issue is what kind of a mechanism do you want to have in place to allow for local citizens to make that determination. And we believe that local citizens ought to be involved in that decision. We opposed the mandatory unification in 1991 because it took local citizens out of that decision-making process. Maybe it was a good idea. Maybe the school districts, the larger school districts that were created out of that process are more efficient and more economical. We've never done any kind of analysis to make that determination. So the issue here in Senate Bill 11 is should local citizens be involved, and we believe they should.
Mr. Representative Dalto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask the superintendent if he'd like to finish his thought. Or were you done?
I guess I'm done at this point. My thought, one other thing that I wanted to share, it's ironic at this point in time that there currently is a bill being considered by the Oregon legislature, which would remove the Ione School District from the Morrow County School District, because it's, you know, that bill speaks to the same thing. Small school districts would like to make the decisions for their school districts. And yes, there are support for smaller school districts through small and remote school funding augmentation. That is what's required. And my point is that small school districts provide a well-rounded education and deserve to continue to be able to provide that well-rounded education in the future.
Okay, thank you very much. And Michelle Hamill.
Good Mr. Chairman and representatives, thank you for allowing us to testify today. My name, for the record, is Michelle Hamill. I am a citizen of Duford, and I am here in support of Senate Bill 11. I have a real short little testimony. I know if I don't read it, I won't say what I want to say. So, excuse me, but I will read it.
No, that's fine.
Senate Bill 11 will eliminate the possibility of a bully-on-the-block takeover of smaller school districts. The original law in the books, ORS 333, allows for one disgruntled district patron with a petition to place a measure on the ballot to merge the entire county school systems with a simple majority vote. It is similar to a hostile takeover. The current countywide statute generates ill feelings and distrust. It will make any action by a new board the subject of a prolonged battle, in essence, another 100 years war over education. During the winter and spring of 2002, Wasco County was divided. A group of dissatisfied District 12 patrons wanted to eliminate their superintendent and current school board. They researched and found ORS 3-33 that would allow them to not only replace their school board and superintendent, but also combine all the school districts into one large district. The county of Wasco has four schools in it, one large, D-12, Adals, one medium, D-9, Chenoweth, and two smaller districts, 29, Duford, and number one, South Wasco County. When you start looking at the potential number of votes in each district, you realize that even if 100% of voters in Chenoweth, Duford, and South Wasco County voted against the measure, a simple majority in the larger district could carry the measure. To have a larger population base vote to take away the rights of the small districts just because they have more voting power is a sorry and unfair turn of events. This could cause the potential of imposing the will of a disinterested majority upon a motivated and caring minority. We were very lucky that the Dallas voters saw the unfairness in the measure and did not pass it. I'm requesting that you assist the small schools or the small school districts in the state by supporting Senate Bill 11. I would hate to have another community go through the issue like we had to. Good public policy strengthens rural communities, and we should try to narrow the division between rural and urban Oregon, not widen it. Senate Bill 11 won't cost the taxpayers any money and will make a win-win situation for the state of Oregon and education. And I'm requesting that you support it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, this is one bill where I came into the hearing truly uncertain as to what the best direction for us to take really would be. And so the testimony for me has been very helpful. But I think I'm inclined to postpone action at this time. We can bring this back Friday. Give me a chance to think about it and to visit with some people about it. And so I think that's what we'll do. So we will do this bill again on Friday. So with that, thank you for coming and testifying. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 11. And we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 761. And Senator Starr, please come up. Senator, I saw you in the back room earlier. I apologize for not interrupting the previous.
That's quite all right. I was able to get back to another committee and vote a bill through the Senate floor. So
you're telling the Senator that you've been busy.
That worked.
Okay. Okay. Fine. Very good.
I appreciate the public hearing and the committee's additional continued work on Senate Bill 761. For the record, I'm Bruce Starr, State Senator in Senate District 15. Representing the communities of Hillsborough, Cornelius, Forest Grove, and North Plains in Western Washington County. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is the homeschool bill that, as the bill passed the Senate, basically completely frees homeschool families from state regulation. We had, a good hearing the last time that you heard this bill. I appreciate very much you listening to that testimony, and I think the good discussion that took place during that hearing. In the process, there were some issues that were raised by folks that are concerned about this bill, and we've attempted to draft a series of amendments to address some of those concerns. What I'd like to do, with the chair's permission, is just briefly outline what each of the dash amendments do, and I'm certain that there was a group of folks that worked closely with the ESDs in particular and working on these amendments that will be able to answer little technical questions, but I can provide kind of a general outline about what it is we have attempted to do here to address some of the concerns folks raised. The dash 4 amendment, you've got a dash 4, a dash 5, a dash 7, and a dash 8. Our group was responsible for the dash 4, dash 7, and dash 8 amendments. So I won't comment on the dash 5 amendments. The dash 4 amendments corrects a timing discrepancy that was pointed out by the Multnomah ESD. Under this amendment, all the provisions of the bill will come into effect at the same time. It's relatively just a technical fix. The dash 7 amendments, what they do is it preserves the opportunity for parents of children with disabilities to obtain individual education services through the public schools that's currently available under administrative rule. Again, it's kind of a technical fix. I think the most substantive of the amendments is the dash 8 amendments. This we worked on in cooperation with ESD. This was an issue that was brought up in your public hearing last time by the Lynn Benton Lincoln ESD representatives regarding the misuse of homeschool law by truant students. With this amendment, students who are enrolled in public school and who have attended or have excused absence for at least the last 25 days of school may begin homeschooling by giving the school written notice of withdrawal. Students enrolled in public schools who have poor attendance records would have to meet this attendance requirement before being allowed to homeschool. There would be a process for principals to waive the attendance requirements for families with extenuating services or circumstances. This is the issue of basically having students disappear, and not knowing what's happening to them. It's an issue that was raised dealing with truancy. I think this is a way to address that. Quite frankly, I think this was an issue that was raised by folks on the Senate floor that had concerns about this bill, and I think that this is a way to help allay some of those concerns that were raised on the Senate floor. In the Senate, we had 20 yes votes and I think 9 no votes, and that some of the folks that ended up opposing the bill, this is one of the issues that they raised, and so I appreciate the ESD helping us come up with, I think, a workable solution so that folks don't just disappear and then basically say, well, we're being homeschooled. This provides at least a written notification and I think is appropriate for a student that's been attending the public school so that we don't just let these students quote, fall through the cracks. With that, Mr. Chair, those are what the amendments do. I obviously appreciate the committee adopting at least the dash 4, 7, and 8. I looked at the dash 5s. They seem to be relatively technical amendments relating to dates. I believe as it relates to home educated kids that take advantage of the opportunity to participate in sports. That's my understanding. I don't necessarily see a problem with those either, but they're not ones that we've brought to the table. Obviously, I would very much appreciate and encourage you to adopt these amendments to take into account some of the concerns that were raised regarding this bill. I'd love very much for the committee to move the amended bill to the House floor so that we can continue to move this issue forward. With these amendments, obviously we'd have to come back to the Senate for concurrence, and it allows us to continue to work with the executive in the building to come to some sort of accommodation there. And we could do that in conference committee if necessary, if these changes don't necessarily allay all of the governor's concerns. Recognizing that committees are on the verge of closing down, and as we try to wrap up our business, that would be my preferred option. Clearly, the decision is with this committee, and I appreciate that very much. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer questions, but I'd also like to, if possible, turn the microphones over to the folks that really worked with the ESDs around the table, nailing these things down. So.
Any questions? Any member? I'd have. Yeah, Representative Barr.
Thank you. And, Senator, in reference to the Dash Act amendments, it seems to me that this is the first time I've had a chance to really read them thoroughly. But a couple of the main issues that kind of were rattling around inside of me, it seems to be addressed. The parent does give written notice to the school district according to Dash Act. Is that correct, I think. And then the 25 days in attendance prior to being withdrawn.
Right, that gets to that. That gets to you're not dealing with kids that are they're missing school all the time.
Yeah, so. I think you've satisfied a lot of my concerns with those amendments. Thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Yes, go to Dave Dalton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Senator Starr, I just had a question on line 21 of the dash 8. Reads 5 unexcused absences. Wondered if there was any discussion about, I suppose, the difference between unexcused and excused absences, and how in some cases, parents could excuse absences for horrible reasons.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dalto, I wasn't, I guess, at the table when these were addressed, and so you might kind of ask the folks that were there, if the excused versus unexcused was taken into account. Again, we're targeting those so-called truant kids, the ones that are missing school a lot, so those, how that issue of excused and unexcused, I'm not sure was that was discussed or not.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Actually, on that point, Senator Starr, on a stock prospectus, they always have the words, past performance is no indication of, future, windfalls or anything like that. And it just occurs to me in reading section 1A, subsection 4, that simply looking at the previous 30 days, 30 days is a snapshot in time, and it won't sort of give us an indication of what their behavior could be like with respect to truancy, either prior to those 30 days or even after those 30 days. So I just wondered if that came up in the discussion.
Well, again, what the concerns I understand that were raised in this committee were kids that were skipping school, quite frankly, and then we're basically going to, if this bill were to pass, the concern was, well, we wouldn't have a technique to track and make sure that these kids are not homeschooled or whatnot, and they, quote, would be lost. I think what we're trying to attempt to get at here is students would have to be attending school in order to take advantage of this law. And so I'm not sure that the issue that you said, well, in order for kids to take advantage of this, home families to take advantage of this, their kids are going to have to be in school. And that's that would be the prerequisite. And I think you've heard a lot of testimony about the success that homeschoolers have enjoyed, and I think why it makes sense to free them from some of the onerous regulation that we've had on them. And this was specifically directed at trying to make sure that we don't have truant kids, to all of a sudden become homeschool kids, with a on a whim.
Well, I appreciate, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, follow up.
I appreciate the great efforts that you've made to address the concerns of the folks that work with truancy. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Farr?
Just one more thing real briefly. when I see late amendments, sometimes I wonder if everybody is satisfied that, you know, you're representing Senator Starr. And I'd like to address that. I've been getting a few phone calls throughout the day today. On
yes, we have been, good been the object of a lot of attention today.
In fact, so many calls that my staff got pretty tired of answering the call, so I started answering for a while. And I would ask that question regarding specifically the elements of these elements that you've outlined here. And most people that I spoke to today had no problem with that. It was other onerous requirements that seem to be the larger problems.
Yeah, it seems to me that this is something that most folks can understand the issue. And again, it was an issue that was raised, and I'm quite frankly pleased that the ESDs kind of came to the table and offered to help us find a solution to it. So I think that's why, in your conversations with folks, they were pretty much thinking that this was maybe a good idea.
Once again, thank you, Senator.
Mm-hmm. Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In that respect, actually, the people that I talked to today didn't know about the amendments, but that's okay. They do seem to like this. I guess my question to you right now, the parents have to sign a form at the ESD, period, end of statement. This puts in some other restrictions and requirements. Isn't this far more restrictive than what the bill actually was trying to get rid of?
I think there's a trade-off here, no question about that. And the trade-off really is a notification versus a testing issue. And what we're talking about here is those, as again, the concern that was raised by folks that testified before this committee, and again, the concerns that were raised on the Senate floor about, you know, those kids that will fall through the cracks, that get lost, you know, the truants, you know, how being able to find out what's happened to these kids. And you know, and then weighing that against the additional regulations that homeschool families are under in this state as it relates to the testing requirements that remain consistent in Senate Bill 761. I believe that the trade-off was one that was from our folks, and I'll let folks hopefully testify behind me to that issue specifically, as they're the ones that are actually homeschooling their children. Can address that issue, but I think that ultimately that the trade-off was deemed worth if it was something a little bit more onerous as far as the notification.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much. And again, I appreciate your work and continue to work on this bill.
Mr. Chair, one
yes.
Question.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
Excuse me, Representative Nolan, yes.
I'm just catching up to you. Have you made any attempt to estimate what it will cost ESDs and local school districts to keep track of all this stuff in the Dash 8s?
I have not tried to track the cost. My sense is that it will be minimum, but because there are already a significant cost because the ESDs have to do all this record keeping as it relates to testing. You remove that mandate from them and you add back a small requirement as far as the notification. It seems to me that the trade-off is to the positive, to the general fund. I don't have hard numbers on it, though. We could try to get something from fiscal if you'd like.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you. We have Steve Novick here from the Department of Education, and we'd ask Steve to come up. And Randy Harnish. Thank you. Is he here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Steve Novick, Legislative Coordinator with the Department of Education. And Superintendent Castillo continues to oppose Senate Bill 761, even with any of these amendments. The superintendent certainly commends Senator Starr and the other folks who have worked on this bill on the Dash 8, because the Dash 8s do address one set of circumstances that was brought to the committee's attention in the last hearing, where you have a kid who has been skipping school regularly, and then it appears the parent just decided, okay, I'll say I'm homeschooling the kid. However, the Dash 8s do not address the situation where a child has never been in school at all, where parents decided from the get-go that we're not going to send our child to school. And since Senate Bill 761 is amended would still eliminate the testing requirement. Society would still have no indication of whether a kid who's never been to school is getting any kind of an education. Also, of course, Senate Bill 761 with the dash 8s doesn't address the situation where a child might have been going to school on a regular basis, but then something happens, there's a change in custody or something, and the child winds up with parents who want to take the kid out of school and are not committed to providing that child an education. So Superintendent Castillo, although appreciating the work that's been done, remains opposed to the bill on the general principle that society should have some assurance that every child is getting an education, because every child is entitled to an education, and she remains convinced that a requirement of periodic testing is not inherently unduly onerous. So, with appreciation for everyone's work, the superintendent remains opposed to the bill.
Okay. Randy, you're... Did you were going to discuss the dash fives? Were those brought by...
It would have, a member from Tom Walter.
Oh, yes. Representative Backman, members of the committee, the Dash 5 amendments were suggested by the executive director of the Oregon School Activities Association as a way, if the bill were to be moved forward, addition of that date would allow a time certain for students who are homeschooled to have completed the assessments that would be required, continue to be required for kids who participate in sports. And a time certain would answer a question and a difficulty that they have found themselves to be in currently, given the kind of the ambiguous language at the end of the year. So that the addition of that August 15th date would address that issue. Scott Perry, who was the representative from the Lynn Benton Lincoln ESD, who was part of these conversations regarding the addressing the issue of truancy and the Dash 8 amendment. In conversations that we had, Mr. Perry indicated that he felt very confident that those discussions were positive and were moving towards solving, you know, the problem particularly regarding truancy. However, he maintains a concern, and I think the desire that for a universal registration process, and still is has questions about eliminating the testing requirements for other than students who participate in athletics.
Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions, if I might, and help me if the person who participated in the ESD conversations is here. I would be glad to defer that till that person is here. But in the meantime, oh, you are, good. Could she come to the
table? Yes, please.
Yeah.
Dorothy is with the homeschool group.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I'd like somebody from the ESD who participated in the discussions. Then, Randy, if you wouldn't mind, I'll go ahead and ask you a couple of them. The first one, I really appreciate the amendments in the Dash 7, amendments, and I think they address some of the issues. I'm a little unclear if a homeschooled child is still receiving special ed services from an ESD. Who is paying for that, since the ADMW does not go to the district or the ESD or anything?
Representative Backlund, Representative Hobson, that was a question that we had in reading these amendments, and that's not clear to my knowledge at this point either.
Follow up?
And I have another question that's more general, and I hesitate, but I don't know who else is coming up, so if you can't answer it, tell me to stuff it and hold it. If I'm reading this correctly, the amendments, was it 4-7, particularly the one that we spent a great deal of time on with Senator Starr, the Dash 8, has some amendments for page 1. And if my understanding was correct, that kind of the balance here was to eliminate some of the registration part, or the testing part, for more tightness on the registration. The testing is on page 2, and I see nothing that even touches page 2.
Chair Backlund, Representative Hobson, my understanding of the Dash 8 amendments, having quickly read them, is that it inserts the requirement for the attendance requirement over the previous 25 days, but does not alter the balance of the bill that eliminates the testing requirement and the registration. It would only require notification in the case of students who were withdrawn from public school to homeschool. It would not have any effect on, as Mr. Novick pointed out, those students who moved from private school to homeschool, or from who had never been in any system at all.
Randy, I have a question that I hope you're going to answer. Deals with ESD responsibility. I think currently ESDs are involved in such things, besides the testing of homeschoolers, involved in such things as being involved in the driver's license certification process. The conditional driver's license. I understand this bill does take care of that. One of the other things, though I'm not sure it does, is ESDs currently do a certification for homeschoolers if they wish to go to community college. And I don't know that any of these amendments deals with that, or at least they were looking for that, and I haven't found it. Or more appropriately, Jim hasn't found it. Can you comment on that?
Representative Backlund, the Education Service District, as the repository of information on students who are homeschooled, would be, into the current system, the source for any kind of certification or evidence that a student is being homeschooled. And I'm not sure, having not looked through this specifically, for that kind of language, if that's addressed. I'm not aware of that. Yeah. Specifically being addressed in the...
If it's not addressed, and if this bill were to move ahead, then that's something that we should address.
I would think so, yes, sir.
And we might ask that question of the proponents of the bill, too, as they come up in a few minutes. Yeah. Okay. Well, we know your position then, the Oregon Department of Education's position on Senate Bill 761.
Okay. Thank you
very much. We have Kevin Sterrett and Marilee Workentin and Dorothy Carmen, please.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, Kevin Sterrett. I am the homeschooling father of two young boys and their principal teacher. I've been at every hearing that this bill has had in both chambers. In the Senate, we were treated to a discussion about a mythological pot-growing family whose children would only be allowed to leave the house to sell marijuana, and that if we pass this law, that we would lose the only mechanism we have to keep this family out of the compassionate arms of the police and social services. And that has been the repeated theory of the opponents of this bill. It presumes, of course, that family that was that type of family was doing nothing else to attract their attention. But the testimony that we've heard has been continually a fear of the accountability of people who homeschool, and the suggestion that if we were to pass this bill, that accountability would be gone. But in the hearing we had in this committee the last time, we heard from a staffer from the Lynn Benton, I guess she was a truant officer of some type, who complained of the large number of families who are neglecting their children and then simply hiding behind the homeschooling law as it exists now, and saying that in order to avoid the responsibility of sending their children to school, they simply filled out the simple form and said they were homeschooling, and then her complaint was that there was really nothing she could do about it. Which makes me wonder why, if there's nothing they can do about it now, why it concerns them so much that we might move ahead and reduce the amount of testing in an area where the existing law is doing nothing to prevent the extremely neglectful parents from doing what they're doing. And I'd also suggest to you that families who are that neglectful are probably going to find a way to create some kind of damage to their children, even if you could force their kids to be handcuffed in public school every single day of the year. So in short, the opponents of this bill have repeatedly created these horrible scenarios of families who are doing these possibly terrible things to their children. In some cases, the arguments were so ridiculous that they would have been offensive if they weren't so funny. But they're also always mentioning the positive experience that they've had with certain homeschoolers who they knew, while the problem people are always left unnamed. In any event, if it's true that the current law doesn't really give these social services any real teeth in the event that a parent is hiding behind the homeschool law, I just simply don't understand how this law would make their job any more difficult or would help those children in any way. I think it's a good bill, and I know there's been some talk about a veto, but I think that, you know, we've spent 8 years of governors saying no to things, and we still have a responsibility to try to move these things forward.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Dalton?
Yeah, I just had a question. Do you believe that there are families that are abusing the homeschool law, or do you believe that there aren't families that are abusing
it? Mr. Chairman, Representative Dalton, I, of course, know a lot of homeschoolers because I associate with them. I don't see that. I'm quite confident, though, that people who are doing that are probably going to be doing other things that would get the attention of this. I don't believe that kind of neglect or abuse takes place in a vacuum. And as other people have pointed out, it really doesn't make a lot of sense for a neglectful parent to be trying to keep their child at home. You know, I can assure you that as a person who does what I do for a living and homeschools two young boys, it's an enormous amount of work which takes every waking hour of my day to complete. And if I wanted to be neglectful or abusive, it would be a lot easier if I sent them off to a government-sponsored daycare center every day.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up?
Well, I appreciate your answer. I follow the logic, but I don't think you answered my question. With respect to the testimony from the truant officer from, well, I think it was Lane County. Lane County. Do you disagree that people are abusing the system?
As I said, Representative, I would have no personal knowledge of anyone doing that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Kevin, do you have any reaction to the amendments?
Well, I only saw the first four until I got here. I don't think any of them are would be a deal killer in my estimation. I understand the concerns that were expressed, that if somebody is allowing their child to be truant, that there should be some mechanism. Is this really the mechanism that would address that? I don't know. But there was one amendment that I saw that specifically determined what a parent must teach, and I think they mentioned civics, economics, history, and English. Oddly enough, I think that was... Am I incorrect about that?
We're not bringing it.
Okay, but those are the ones that have been faxed to me by Senator Starr's office. But there's nothing in the amendments that I think would be a major problem for somebody who wanted to proceed with the bill.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good.
So, am I up?
Yes, you're up. If you're ready, we're ready.
Okay. Chair Backlund, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Marilee Warkentine. I reside in Springfield, Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to address my issues of concern with Senate Bill 761. I've been a homeschool parent for this past 8 years. I am one right now, too, and I oppose Senate Bill 761. I'm going to feel alone here in the middle of it. I feel this proposal will hurt the quality of education that some homeschool children receive. I hold a current Oregon Elementary Teaching Certificate. Because of this, I was approached to test homeschoolers in my home. I now test about 50 students annually. Most of these students are getting an excellent education, and this will not change under Senate Bill 761. There are, however, students who are not doing well. These students and their families are the ones I'm concerned about. In Lane County, there are 24% of the homeschooled children, and in 2002 scored below the 50th percentile on the standardized test. Currently, I go over these test results with parents that I test in my home and suggest resources and curriculum that can help them with their children. I also try to connect my families with homeschool support groups. Without testing, it could be years before some of these children get the help that they need, if ever. In a perfect world, all homeschool parents would be wonderful, attentive, and organized teachers. Our world is not perfect, and neither are all homeschool parents. The reality is some are very busy with other areas of their lives. Knowing that testing is required nudges some of these parents to focus on basic education skills at least long enough to get their students through the test every few years. The tests give a baseline from which you can measure your child's progress. Testing also can shed light on learning disabilities or gaps in understanding of concepts which are not necessarily picked up by parents. Please don't remove this source of evaluation and accountability. Senate Bill 761 will not improve the quality of education for homeschool students. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you say that you do testing and evaluation of your colleagues, your homeschool colleagues, is that in addition to what the ESD does?
The ESD in Lane County doesn't really perform very many tests themselves. They homeschool most testers. The only requirement to give a homeschool child a standardized test. The requirement is that you were a certified teacher in the state of Oregon when you applied to give students tests. And then if you met that qualification and you have the testing materials available to you, you can give the test to homeschoolers. You don't have, the ESD doesn't have to give the test.
Follow up.
Thank you. That helps a little. I think that it confused me also. Are you then hired by the ESD to perform this function?
No, I am hired by homeschool parents to administer one of the state required tests to their children.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Backlund, members of the committee, thank you for scheduling a hearing and a work session on Senate Bill 761. For the record, my name is Dorothy Carmen. I'm on the board of the Oregon Christian Home Education Association Network. I also homeschooled my two children, who are now long graduated from homeschooling. One is training to be a firefighter paramedic, and the other is graduating third in her class from college 2 weeks from now, so I'm very proud of them. I would, Chair Bethlen, I'd like to ask some advice to begin with. Do I need to go back through some of the testimony that supported our reasons for Senate Bill 761, or do I assume that that testimony was given on Monday and I can address just the amendments?
My feeling is that we took notes and we heard the testimony, and I think we were good listeners that day, so I would recommend that you move on to your interpretation or analysis of the amendments.
Okay. Yeah. That's what I'm prepared to do.
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay. I'm going to work backwards, too. I'm going to start with what I feel is the most important amendment, and that is the Dash 8 amendments. They're the ones we worked on with Mr. Perry from the Lynn Benton Lincoln ESD to address the issue of habitually truant students misusing the proposed homeschool law. Representative Farr, you had asked a question about, isn't this still registering? And the answer is no. This is withdrawing only those students that have been in the public schools and writing a letter for those students. For the homeschool students, as the Department of Education mentioned, that have either been transferring from private school or have always been homeschooled, there will be no keeping track of those students. So it keeps the original intent of Senate Bill 761 in removing the notification requirements. This is just to address those students that were of concern to the ESD who were habitually truant, and then when they were faced with charges of truancy were saying, oh, you can't get me because I'm homeschooled. So that's what this amendment addresses. It is, because the only way to catch them was to actually identify all the students that are in public school withdrawing, any student that is in public school has to withdraw. just those that are habitually truant are the ones that have to prove that they are there a certain number of days, or have a meeting with the principal which would allow them a waiver if there were extenuating circumstances such as illness, or the child had been beat up by the neighborhood bully so often that he wasn't coming to school and the parents decide they want to homeschool him. The principal has entire discretion in those cases where the child is habitually truant and the parent has asked for a meeting. The principal has discretion whether or not to allow the family to homeschool in those situations. Now, if the child can get his or her act together and start attending school, then and be in attendance 20 out of 25 days of school, then the parent can withdraw the child from public education. The 20 out of 25 days was the recommendation of the ESD, of Mr. Perry from the ESD. This was a tool that the truant officer wanted to be able to have to use, to have in their toolbox, they mentioned last time they were here, that would allow them to get into discussions with the family so that the family just won't disappear using the homeschool law. I do have to concur with Mr. Harnish. In corresponding with Mr. Perry, he did state that he still has concerns about the general tenor of Senate Bill 761, that he still feels, even though he's worked on this amendment with us, he does still feel that there should be registration and testing. And just in fairness, I want to let you know I concur with that. We believe that the Dash 8 amendments to Senate Bill 761 make it stronger and answer the question of truant students misusing the proposed homeschool law. We urge you to pass the Dash 8 amendments. The Dash 4 amendments address an implementation issue brought up by Multnomah ESD. The original implementation dates for most of the bill are July 1st, 2003. However, that kind of left the ESD responsible to send letters to the traffic, the DMV, for permits for driving long after that they were stopping, they were no longer tracking the homeschoolers. And so this just is to clean up that date. And the Dash 7 amendments make sure that those homeschool students qualifying for IEPs in conjunction with homeschooling will continue to be able to access those services. Currently, homeschoolers who qualify for IEP services in conjunction with homeschooling receive them based on the current OARs. And to be frank, I don't know how they're funded, but I would not assume that this amendment would change the funding of that in any way. As to some of the other unintended consequences that were mentioned, specifically Representative Backman brought up the community college issue. There are, and I've got too many papers here. The problem actually is not with the community colleges, it's when we want to take the GED, when we want our 16 and 17-year-old students to take the GED. There is an administrative rule that requires us in that circumstance to get a letter from the ESD stating that our child is not required to be in school, and therefore the child can take the GED. It's just basically saying that this child is exempt from compulsory attendance laws. That is OAR 589-007-0400. Under that same section, a parent of a private school student who wants their 16 or 17-year-old to take the GED needs to certify to the authorized GED chief examiner that the applicant is exempt from compulsory school attendance because they're a private school student, and that the parent or legal guardian shall specifically indicate that the applicant has permission to take the GED test. The OARs, to clean up this issue, the OARs could be similar for homeschools and private schools in that issue. The private school students don't have to have a note from the private school that they're exempt from compulsory attendance. The parent can certify that. Same thing can happen for homeschools. Regarding the community colleges, according to statute and rule, and I don't know if Mr. Keller came up with anything, but looking as hard as I could, there's no requirement in statute or rule that requires the ESD to certify that homeschool students are exempt from compulsory attendance in order to attend the community colleges. In fact, we did a quick survey of the community colleges in the areas where we live, and none of them require a letter from the ESD for a 16 or 17-year-old to attend community college. All they require is that the student take their basic entrance exam. In fact, ORS 341-505, talking about admission of students to community colleges, it states, in the case of a student younger than 16 years of age, the college administration shall make the final determination. So the ORSs don't even address the 16 and 17-year-olds, and they say, in case of a younger student, the college decides. So there's no, as far as I could find, there are no requirements for a letter from the ESD in order for a homeschool child to attend community college when they are under 18. I believe those are all the unintended consequences that have been brought to our attention. We addressed some of them with amendments. Others, I believe, can be addressed in OAR or do not need addressing at all. We would urge you to pass the amendments to the bill and also pass the bill, send the bill to the House for a vote and debate. This bill is obviously very important to us. My husband and I have been coming to the legislature actually since 1985 working toward this end. It is a basic philosophical difference between our position and the Department of Education's position, which you heard earlier, and I wish I knew how to take shorthand. Basically, he said that society should have the ability to keep track of every child and to make sure that every child had the opportunity for education. The federal government, as I mentioned last week in the No Child Left Behind Act, has specifically acknowledged that home education, like other private education, is not subject to oversight of the federal government. We are not required under the No Child Left Behind Act to be subject to any of the testing required in that act or to any of the curriculum control in that act. The Supreme Court, as I mentioned last week, supports a parent's rights to direct the upbringing and education of a child. And that is one of the reasons I have worked so many years toward this end. We're getting closer each time, we hope. We really urge you to give this vote, this bill, a chance to have a vote on the floor, to go to committee and perhaps address some more issues, but to actually let the governor have a chance to veto it if he so chooses. I would love to be able to see the process go through and to have him be able to make that choice. I will take any questions at this time.
Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple, if I could please. If I'm understanding correctly, then what the amendments would do would make it so that children who never enter the system would never be entered into the system. They would be non-existent as far as public education record keeping is concerned.
Representative Backman, Representative Hobson, that is correct. It's very similar to what happens to private school students in the state of Oregon now. They are not entered into the system in any way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another one to make sure. Have you talked to any principals or administrators in regard in having the principal of a school be the arbiter or the decision maker in regard to whether or not a child is homeschooled?
Chair Backlund, Representative Hobson. Again, this is for a small number of students, not all students, only those that are habitually truant. And quite frankly, I left that up to Mr. Perry to suggest who should be the mediator in that instance.
One more.
Okay, fine.
If we have new students, 4 and 5 years old, who are just entering the system, who would not be entering the system, who would not be part of the record keeping, who would not be registered, how do we identify or work with parents to identify kids with special needs?
Representative Backlund, Representative Hobson. If I remember my work with the Oregon Department of Education on the special needs portion of the current homeschool bill, there is a provision from the federal government that's called Child Find. And children can be identified through any number of ways. As you mentioned, 4 and 5 year olds who aren't in the system, the parents can refer them, others can refer them. The responsibility of the state is to offer an evaluation. But for all students, not just homeschooling school students, the parents have the ability to decline the offer of the evaluation. Once the evaluation has been made, if the parents agree to it, and an IEP is set up for children, parents have the decline, the opportunity to decline the services. The state has the responsibility to offer a free and appropriate education to a student who would qualify for an IEP. And the current rules require that offer to be made by the school annually. I do not see any change in Senate Bill 761 any way that it would change either the responsibilities of the state or the ability of Child Find to identify students.
Can I speak one more?
Sure.
Mr. Chair. And I am definitely one of those persons who says by far the majority of the homeschool people do a wonderful job. But for those who don't, on the -8 amendments at the bottom, and it says if a child who's enrolled had more than 5 unexcused absences, the legal guardian may not withdraw that child. Why would this 5 or 10% of parents that we're talking about not just lie and say, oh yeah, I forgot, my kid was sick, I now do want to withdraw them? I don't see that this gets rid of the problem with the truant.
Chair Backlund, Representative Hobson, this was basically the suggestion of Mr. Perry at the ESD, and they felt that this was adequate to address those. I, to be honest, do not understand the workings of the school and how they identify excused absences and unexcused absences, how they qualify. But this was a tool that the truant officer and Mr. Perry had asked for.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nolan.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I think you're the right person to answer this question, but I don't know. So if I'm just looking for information. I'm particularly focusing on the -8 amendments and the issue that Representative Hobson introduced about students who never enroll in a public school, and therefore those amendments don't apply to them. It's my understanding, and I want to know if I'm correct or if you can put me on the right track, that most students who are taught at home for their entire educational career, at least through the equivalency of a high school education. So doesn't that, if I'm correct, doesn't that mean then that most students would never be subject to those amendments?
Chair Backlund, Representative Nolan, that is indeed correct. The original intent of the bill was to remove homeschool students from supervision of the state because we strongly believe that homeschooling is private schooling, that it is not public education. Home education is not public education, should not be publicly supervised. Your assumption is true. The bill has not changed in its basic construction based on the -8 amendments.
If I might follow up more with a comment than a question, Mr. Chair. I think therein, although there are lots of aspects to the proposed bill and the amendment, I think therein is probably, for me, the nub of the question. And although I am mindful of issues relating to the exceptions, I think the difference is that I do believe that society has a legitimate interest in the education of all children, whether it is provided through a public school system or through a private school system or privately in homes, and that the way we know that that's happening is by providing some testing. So I appreciate your clarifying that for me.
Chair Backman, Representative Nguyen. That is the major difference, I believe, philosophically, that people have had with the bill, is whether or not the state should be the supervisor for all students, or whether or not the parents should have their First and 14th Amendment rights upheld and be able to direct the upbringing and education of their children. And in Wisconsin versus Yoder, the Supreme Court did acknowledge the right of the state to make laws that require students to be educated. But they said parents' rights trump that. And that happened in Peers for Society Sisters when the Oregon State tried to require all students to get a public education. This was in 1922. And the Supreme Court said, and this was in testimony on Monday that I had, I'm sorry I don't have it before me here, but basically the Supreme Court said that the statist notion that all students should receive a public education is wrong, and that parents have the responsibility and high duty to direct the upbringing and education of their children. And so that's where we are philosophically coming from. In addition, you have the state of Oregon has chosen to minimally monitor private education in Oregon. I can start a private school. I don't have to tell anybody I'm starting it. I can recruit students from down the block. I don't have to notify anybody. They don't have to be tested. If the state feels that amount of supervision for private education is adequate, the law should be applied equally to the other form of private education, which is home education.
As I said, I was not asking a question. I was simply clarifying my position on the bill and the policy. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much. I should announce that the last item on our agenda, we're not going to make that today. We have a 3:00 commitment to a floor session, and we will bring back HJR 56 on Friday. I think we can stay a few minutes beyond 3:00 because at the beginning, besides roll call, there's typically other things, so we can stay a few minutes longer. We have 4 people who have signed up who have yet to speak: Brian Ray and Roger Williams and Amy Grant and Jean Biggerstaff. Okay. Is Brian here? Yeah. Let's bring up Brian and Amy Grant and Jean Biggerstaff. Oh, okay. Very good.
I have written some I can give to you. Does she need right here?
Thank you very much. Brian Ray, I live in Salem, Oregon, and Representative Backlund and others. Very quickly, just so you have a little background, I have been a professor of education at the undergraduate and graduate levels, teaching teachers. I've taught in public and private schools in Oregon, undergraduate and graduate university level, and I've testified before state legislatures all across the nation on issues specifically related to homeschooling, and I've also testified in courts on homeschooling. like they say in the classroom, please don't read the testimony, it will distract you. But very, very simply, I guess I would say, because so many things have been covered, that I think it's very well established by research that others have done and I've done, homeschoolers do well. Nobody's contesting that concept. Secondly, I find it very fascinating that as I travel the nation and do research and testify, that basically the same issues come up over and over again. There's basically nothing new here. And I've seen in several states that the state governments have decided that they really should recognize the primary and final authority of parents in the education and upbringing of their children, and have moved toward basically saying that if parents do not choose the state education offered by the state, then they're not a part of it. And that's basically what this law does, and I know that Representative Nolan and some others have alluded to that. It is a very simple thing. The Oregon Constitution and the United States Constitution both, neither of them give the state the right or authority to try to make sure that all children get an education, first of all. Now, whether they can make laws to say they'll get educated, that's another matter, because they do it in a lot of states. What I do find fascinating is that as we go across the nation, almost homogeneously, the only people who oppose this kind of law are teachers' unions, some state education officials, and once in a while, a homeschooler who somehow makes money testing homeschoolers. I saw that in Pennsylvania last year, where there was a huge outpouring on a bill that would try to, in essence, give homeschoolers more freedom. And those are the people who generally oppose this kind of thing. I would also suggest that it is very clear, due to the nature of law in Oregon, the way private schools are treated, that if, in fact, those who oppose Senate Bill 761 have full integrity, that they would have to start pressing you right now for laws to track, test, register, and notify the state regarding all children by name in private schools, whether they're Roman Catholic, whether they're Lutheran, whether they're Baha'i, pagan, Muslim, or humanist. If they had integrity, they would need to start to promote those laws immediately, because the presupposition is that de facto, the state is in charge of making sure that all children get an education that is as per measured by standardized academic achievement tests. If that's not true, then there is no reason logically why this law is not the right kind of law. And finally, the research evidence, and you have it in the written testimony there, shows clearly, the research that I've done and others have done, that nationwide, when we organize states by how much regulation they have over homeschoolers, whether none, a moderate amount, or a high amount of regulation, and it's most of the research I've done, and it's been reviewed, there is absolutely no correlation. And a key piece of scientific research is that there has to be at least a correlation for there to even be a suggestion of a causation. So there's absolutely no evidence that state-controlled homeschooling will either keep or raise children's test scores, or find the ones who, for example, was testified about might be having their children, you know, being a marijuana growing family business. I watched that testimony too. There's absolutely no evidence for that. And so the burden of proof is on those who would oppose this bill to show that factually, and then, of course, philosophically. So I'll end my testimony right there, and if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Okay.
Representative Backlund, Chairman Backlund, and members of the committee, my name is Amy Grant. I'm the president of the Oregon Home Education Network. I'd like to just very briefly make sure that all the questions that have been raised by the committee get answered. Representative Galto questioned the five unexcused absences versus excused absences. I think as Mrs. Carmen mentioned, this language came from the ESD. Because we're not in the system, I don't know the difference between excused and unexcused. But I'm sure that there are mechanisms in place if a school believes that the excused absences are being abused. I'm sure that there's some way to ask for verification of the validity of the excuse for all children, whether they're choosing to homeschool or not. So that is my assumption, that because it was proposed by the ESD, they feel comfortable that they have a mechanism to determine whether something is excused or unexcused.
as well as the past 25 days. So the schools have no, can any parent?
Typically, Amy, I think on an excused, when a student is absent from school, the parent will call or most probably will send a note with the kid asking that he or she be excused. The reasons for the excuse have been broadened over the years. The key, then, is that the parent writes the note and asking for an excuse. That usually does it.
So a parent could, for example, take a child on vacation, and that would be considered excused?
I think generally that would be yes.
Well, then I guess I would have to rely on the fact that Mr. Perry suggested making that distinction. Mm-hmm. So I don't have any further answer then to your question. Representative Nolan asked about the cost to keep track of the Dash 8 amendment requirements, and our understanding from speaking with the attendance officer from the Lynn Benton Lincoln ESD is that they already know who those families are. They are concerned specifically about the families that they are already tracking. My understanding also, again, I'm not in the school system, is that schools already keep attendance, and so this was not raised as an additional burden on the ESDs. The ESDs proposed this mechanism, and I would assume that the reduction in their burden from no longer having to track homeschoolers and require that request test scores would, to some extent, offset any additional cost to track these truant students if they're not already tracking them.
Amy?
Yes.
I have a question. It's been suggested to me by a number of people. If we did away with the testing, how would we know then how well the homeschoolers are doing? Right now we know homeschoolers are doing well because test results are posted.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe you're saying that that's not the state's concern or should not be the state's concern.
Philosophically, yeah. I would say that is not the state's concern. That just like children in private school, the state should be concerned with children in the public education system. I would also say that there are many ways of measuring success, and any look at the national academic competitions, Destination Imagination, chess tournaments, spelling bees, geography bees, admissions to college, all show that home education is very effective. In fact, at Stanford University, their acceptance rate for homeschoolers is twice as high as it is for children that come from the classroom. So I would suggest that there are many, many ways of ascertaining homeschooling effectiveness, and I would also suggest that we're past that question. There is enough evidence nationally to show that home education, because it involves a high degree of parental involvement and can be customized to that child's needs, is inherently has a very high success rate.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah,
let the record show that I was defeated at just after lunch in less than 5 minutes by a young man from the Waldo Middle School playing chess just outside. I thought I'd interject that.
That doesn't show much.
Representative, does that speak to his ability or to your inability? Or both.
I thought I'd lighten the mood after 2 hours.
Thank you.
I would also like to comment the amendments, the language in Dash 4, which was the timing discrepancy, the language in Dash 7, Dash 8, and Dash 5 were acceptable to the group of us who have been proponents of this bill. So all four of those were quite acceptable. Representative Hobson asked who pays now for children who are homeschooled who receive IEP services. Like Mrs. Carman, I don't know the answer, but this law doesn't change that. So, however, my assumption had been that the school district was receiving compensation for services being provided to homeschooled students. And in fact, some school districts are pulling back from offering IEP services unless the students are enrolled full-time. So this is not changing the current system. It's just trying to make clear that what's currently in place will continue in place.
Mr. Chair. Representative Farr.
As we become very pressed for time, may I ask a couple of quick questions?
Sure.
Currently, who on the state testing, who pays for that?
families. Some ESDs, I believe the Lake County, mm-hmm. and at one point I believe Clackamas County, offered testing. In most ESDs, including the other large ones that I'm familiar with, parents pay.
That's different.
And the cost of that to homeschoolers is about $250,000 a year.
Okay. Another question. Do you also pay property tax?
Yes, we do.
And do you get any kind of credit on your property tax?
No, we don't.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Hobson, you also asked about the burden on the principal to be the arbiter. The principal can designate anybody. The principal could designate an attendance officer from the ESD. Our goal was just to try to address the situation locally. So if there is a truancy problem, let's let the school or the ESD handle that truancy problem. We were trying to be very specific as to the solution. Again, Mr. Perry from the ESD did not seem to have concerns about the principal or designee.
Mr. Chair, could I respond to that?
Yes, Representative Hobson.
I guess my concern there is that you're putting the school district in the position of saying yes or no, whereas now all you have to do is sign a piece of paper at the beginning of every year. And I'm not sure school district personnel actually would relish. I know I wouldn't have when I was the principal, being the one to decide yay or nay on that. What happens if you decide nay? You're not going to homeschool.
To be very honest, we're very concerned about that, too. That level of discretion takes us back to pre-1985 days. And that was a compromise. I would prefer to have very objective standards. The reason that that level of discretion is there is that we are trying to address this issue of truant families without precluding families that are facing, you know, a serious problem that is preventing their child from attending. That was the best. It's a compromise. You also asked, how do we identify young children with special needs? I believe that was answered. We do have Child Find. It is really the same situation for children that go directly into a private school. The state does not, they don't enter the public education system at any point. They do not enter a public education assessment. So we are asking for equivalent treatment. I believe that Representative Dalto asked, are there parents that abuse the system, abuse the current law? I have to go by what the attendance officer from Lynn Benton Lincoln mentioned, and I believe that she was speaking honestly and truthfully. I believe that there are truant families. I believe that Representative Nolan asked, are most students who are taught at home their entire school career? I would answer slightly differently than Mrs. Carmen. Maybe it's because of my own experience. I would say there are at least as many children who begin homeschooling from within the school system as there are who begin it, who homeschool all the way through. I think that varies all over the place. But most of the homeschoolers that I come in contact with through the OHEN helpline are ones who are leaving the public school. I'd be happy to answer any other questions that anyone has.
Okay. Well, there's a name of a movie, Rush to Judgment, and I don't know that we want to do that. We've heard and seen a number of amendments today, and we've had lots of testimony, and we're kind of pressed to rush to the floor of the for the session, so I think we'll not go to work session, but we will undoubtedly be getting back to Senate Bill 761. So with that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 761, and we will adjourn the meeting.